Well, good afternoon. I'm Julio Montaner, and I'm going to moderate the afternoon session. Let me call on Manoj Kurian, who is a senior manager who heads the policy and advocacy work for the International Society, to come to the front. He's going to be moderating the next session. Manoj.
Thank you, Julio. I'll be stepping in for my executive director, Bertrand Audouin. This session, we are dealing with the country's perspectives of TASP. You know, as viruses do not need visas, so they do cross borders, unlike human beings. But of course, diseases are usually managed at the country level, and it makes a big difference which country you are living in. And so I think this session is very critical, and unfortunately, one of the resource persons has not come, but there are two of our eminent resource persons, Dr. François Darby, who's a medical doctor and professor of epidemiology at the School of Public Health of the University of Bordeaux, Saguenay in France. He has 25 years' experience of research in HIV epidemiology and global health, and he actually leads up research extensively in different parts of the world. And he will focus on research primarily on South Africa and Côte d'Ivoire. So, Dr. François, please. Yeah. And we are also, it's a privilege also for us to have Dr. Fuji Zhang, who is a renowned infectious disease physician in China, who's trained in epidemiology. He is currently the director of the National Center for AIDS STD Control and Prevention in Beijing. Please come.
Okay, good afternoon. I'm going to, so I'm not an implementer, but a researcher, but I'm going to bring you some perspective from several African countries, trying to highlight the most recent research findings that are relevant to the implementation of TASP on this continent. And I will finish by discussing some of our own ongoing work in South Africa. So as a caveat, and it was already presented this morning by Wafa El-Sadr, we have to remember that the general introduction of ARVs has changed dramatically over the past years, and that at the moment we are at a stage where we are targeting about 25 million with the most recent WHO guidelines, whereas with the TASP approach we should move from there to 32 million. But still, if we were fully implementing the WHO 2013 guidelines, we will be very close to TASP anyway. The second part of the caveat regarding the 2013 WHO guidelines is this issue of consolidation along the continuum of care. And now it's not only a matter of treating people or initiating ART, but really moving to a great level of HIV testing, introducing people in care, initiating first-line treatment, monitoring second line and third line, with all the operational and service delivery challenges that are throughout this. My take on this is that when we move from this 2013 guideline to TASP, we are simply exacerbating the same issues of consolidation along the continuum of care, and we will face exactly the same problems, simply at an even higher level. So I'll take three aspects of it in my talk. I'll start by looking at the HIV testing issue, then at the effectiveness information and focus then on the end on the operational and service delivery. So let's start by HIV testing and what are the latest news, some of them presented by Wafa this morning, but I'll try to go even slightly further. Clearly, the efforts of provider-initiated counseling and testing have been enormous, but grossly insufficient. And this was, and most of this data came from the African continent and other resource-limited settings. But clearly, there has been incredible limitations with the provider-initiated counseling and testing approach. So, with this mixed bag of results, hopefully, there has been a move now for several years, and especially on the African continent, on home-based counseling and testing. And the very good news came last year when a large approach of systematic review of these the published findings showed roughly an uptake around 88% for testing and 77% for test results. Many of these studies, if not all, came from the African continent. More recently, there was even another systematic review, I think mentioned by Wafa this morning, on a broader array of community-based counseling and testing, meaning anything outside health facilities, and again, most of the time in resource-limited settings. And that proves that regardless of the method you use, the approach you use, and the setting where you are in the different target groups, the same result, positive results of home-based counseling and testing are demonstrated. And I will refer as an example of a very provocative approach, the Malawi randomized cluster trial on home-based testing that is presented here by Peter McPherson in poster number one. So is there any direct effect on counseling and testing that we can accept or have before we move to ART introduction? Again, it has been demonstrated by several studies summarized in the Cochrane review that counseling and testing, in generally speaking, has improved HIV-related risk behavior. But unfortunately, despite many attempts, the findings on the direct relation between counseling and testing and acquisition of HIV are, to say the least, modest and not extremely impressive. So that's unfortunate, but with regard to the implementation of TASP, this should not really delay the process of moving more to home-based testing in as many ways as possible, because counseling and testing will be a prerequisite or is a prerequisite to ARV-based biomedical prevention such as TASP. I'd like to move on the second end of this, which is the effectiveness of reduction in HIV transmission, and share with you what is new on the African continent in terms of information, or more generally speaking. First of all, this systematic review of HIV transmission between couples in which the positive partner was fully suppressed on antiretroviral therapy showed that the rate of transmission per 100 person years is really extremely low. Now it's becoming even clearer now than it was with HPTN052 that in more real life settings you can get very, very interesting results with RRT use at the moment under a relatively strict condition. The last piece of information I wanted to share with you with regard to new data on effectiveness is the study that was recently finalized and that is now in press and that comes from Côte d'Ivoire. So Côte d'Ivoire is different from the other settings that were in the systematic review that I just described, in the sense that heterosexual partnership is more diverse than it is, and so the concept of a stable heterosexual couples is not the dominant acquisition of infection. This study was done in the context of a randomized trial in which people are randomized to receive either a standard ART according to local guidelines or ART according to early treatment between 350 and now 800 CD4. So we are moving very close to a TASP approach. And in this study, which is nested within the trial itself, the estimated protective effect of early ART, so again between 350 and 800 CD4, has been estimated by the investigators at 90% with a relatively narrow confidence interval. Finally, as far as effectiveness is concerned, I do not know any other study at the moment on HIV incidence that the one that was presented this morning in KwaZulu-Natal. Remember that in this study, ART has been gradually introduced in this rural community. The more it moves from green to red, the more coverage there is of ART under the regular use of ART with South African guidelines. And what you see here is the risk of acquisition of infection if you live in a small community according to the coverage of ART in this community. So I know this morning Alan Whiteside questioned this trend with regard to confidence interval, but what you can clearly say, either it's adjusted on age and sex or adjusted on many other variables, is that there is still very positive trend or negative trend, if you want, between the coverage of ART in the community and the risk of acquisition of HIV by those who are negative and living in the same community. Yes, the confidence intervals are still large, but the trend looks quite interesting. And again, the ART is used according to South African guidelines. So let me finish this general discussion by putting some of the operational and service delivery challenges into perspective. There are three types. The health system concerns, the resource constraints, and the behavioral concerns. As far as health system concerns are concerned, I will mention the healthcare-seeking behavior, whether people who are asymptomatic and perfectly healthy or feel perfectly healthy are going to seek care, and how we are going to improve attraction to the health system. Again, the Malawi trial reported here in this conference as a poster is very provocative, with home-based initiation of ART as a mean to improve healthcare seeking behavior. I won't touch too much on the resource constraints, because they are obvious both on the financial, human, and organizational aspects, and I'll spend just one or two slides on the behavioral concern of the risk compensation. So the question for the risk compensation is that, will there be a risk compensation with ART and with increasing time of ART initiation? The evidence of early of initiation of ART until 2000 showed that was certainly limited, but did not favor this hypothesis. So the question is whether there is new evidence now from the African continent, at least, that goes into this direction. There are two findings that are very recent and are quite reassuring and interesting. First of all, in the same community where I show you the HIV incidence impact study where it was conducted in rural KwaZulu-Natal, a lot of behavioral studies were done and show no evidence of increased sexual risk-taking in the general population while ART was scaled up, again using South African guideline recommendations. And condom use with regular sexual partner increased, and proportion with multiple sexual partners decreased. So all of this goes in the right direction. And in Abidjan, Côte d'Ivoire, in the trial that I just described, where half of the people were receiving a treatment between 350 and 800 CD4, the same study that I just described earlier, the authors have described what they call risky sex, and risky sex was reported by 10% of those on early ART versus 12.8% of those on standard ART, which is absolutely no difference. So these are good information on the risk compensation issue that has been pending for many, many years. Finally, I'd like to say that if we want to go any further in implementing TASP, we need certainly to have more high-level evidence for feasibility, efficiency, and effectiveness. And we know that at the moment, most of this advanced evidence will come from randomized trials at community level. Wafa mentioned this morning 4 trials, and I indeed can share the same information on these 4 trials that are ongoing at the moment. And I will just spend the last few minutes sharing with you some of the information of our trial, not because it is ours, but because it is slightly more advanced than the others that have not been able to report it so far. A lot of information. So, the update as of today that I will share with you is also in the poster where we show you some of the behavioral studies that are ongoing around the trial. And this is a cluster randomized trial in the same district or sub-district where the impact studies that you saw earlier have taken place. The protocol has been now fully described in an open access journal a few weeks ago, and I'll refer to it. I will advise you to look at it to understand the details of how we proceed. Basically, we proceed in two phases. The first one is to look at acceptability and feasibility of the TASP intervention at both individual and community level, and therefore infer on the parameters on which we have hypothesized the continuation of the trial at full scale. This randomized trial has 2 components, and for which of them I have highlighted in red what is new compared to what the South African program does. So of course, there has been in this community a lot of community and clinic HIV testing, but what we do and implement for all the communities in which we work is regular, 3 times, in fact, rounds of home-based HIV testing, again, along the lines of what has been shown earlier as being effective, but even going one step further by doing repeat testing in this community. In addition, of course, the preventive services that are available in South Africa are maintained and expanded. The second component of the trial divides the communities into the control arm and the intervention arm. In the control arm, we continue to follow the national South African guidelines, whereas in the intervention arm, after the home-based testing approach, we offer universal immediate ART initiation. The district is fairly rural. The population, the total population is large, but we are working on about a 10 to 15% sample of this population, and the prevalence is among the highest in the country of South Africa. Let me share with you the very, very early results, and to be honest, that's the first time in a conference we report some of these results that are still preliminary. They are only based on the round one of home testing, so that does not imply what is going to happen with the future rounds of testing. But basically, at the moment, in these first 10 clusters, we have registered about 11,000 people, be able to contact 8,300, out of which 94% participated and 82% had their HIV status ascertained with a prevalence of about 30%. And as you can see, at the moment, after just one round of approach in the community, we had a total linkage to care of about 72%. It's hard to say whether that will be the final figures of this phase one feasibility, but compared to our sample assumptions, in our model assumptions, we it seems to be that we are getting either close or even possibly better than what we had anticipated. So I'd like to finish by putting some concluding remarks on how I see a TASP in the field. I have a terminology dilemma in the sense that I found personally now that I have our trial is called TASP, that TASP is a wrong term in the sense that it's too restrictive or it doesn't capture everything of what we want to do. So if we keep TASP, maybe TASP means something like treat as soon as possible. I'm not the only one to say this. Or we should stick to something different like universal test and treat, which you could also say if you do TTU, you go say it in French as well. But so I feel the TASP treatment as prevention at the moment is a problem even in communicating what we mean. Second is that based on the different pieces of evidence that I shared with you and others, it's very likely that TASP will happen in the sense that we will treat more and more people and probably close to everybody. The question is how, and the different operational questions that I highlighted in this talk and among the media around the continuum of care will need to be addressed to find solutions that allow us to go into this direction. I'm not touching of the who will pay, but it's obvious that we need to have more resources to do that. And on the when issue, I would say that in the coming year or years, there will be more and more solid evidence on feasibility and acceptability, at least on the African continent, that will shape the rest of the TASP implementation in the field. Whether and how the effectiveness will be measured in the following years remains probably an unanswered question at the moment, especially considering the evolution of the 2013 guidelines. I'd like to acknowledge those with whom we work, especially on the South Africa and Côte d'Ivoire projects and at the agency in Paris, and I'd like to thank you for your attention.
Thank you, Dr. Dabi, for this really latest information. We can have a few questions before we go into the next presentation. Because it is, of course, looking into the country, but also giving some latest scientific data.
I have one question for you in regards to the ANRS study. What are the contingency plans if South Africa were to move to the 500 as a standard of care? 500 plus zero discordance and the rest of it.
Yes. In fact, this is something we have speculated would happen at some point in time. The fact that we are finishing in the coming 4 to 5 months the phase one pretty much corresponds to the time where South Africans will have to make some decisions. So we will have to decide based on the findings that I just shared with you that are very premature at the moment and the evolution of the guidelines whether a strict randomized approach comparing two arms as we did is still the best way or if alternate plans are more appropriate or different modes of delivery of the intervention are also compared because even in the past year, we have learned on some occasions it was not so easy to introduce TASP as we were planning. So maybe this is what will happen.
That's Giulio Maria Corbelli from Italy. Thank you for your very interesting presentation. I have a general comment. It is very marginal to this presentation. It is not personal to you, Professor Nabi. But when I hear something like universal testing, I'm always afraid that the voluntary basis of this procedure is forgotten. And since there are cases, as we have seen in Greece in the past months, where forced testing is going to happen, is happening, I would like to recommend everybody to always remember that universal testing must be voluntary and human rights must be respected in this strategy.
Thank you very much. Yes, maybe the word universal then creates other concerns. At least for what I can mention for the South African perspective is that there's been a lot of work at the community level of introducing the many aspects of the project before moving to the field. And this is because there was a strong interest from the community leaders, that we continue to move. And my belief is that irrespective of the place where you will do it, the same concerns will have to be addressed with the communities.
thank you very much. My name is Zengani Chirwa from Malawi. And it's more of a comment, and I just want to get your views on that. In Malawi, we have sort of looked at the implications of the new guidelines. So if you take discordant 500, universal access for pregnant women and children, we find only 15% is left not eligible. So essentially we think were basically already almost there on test and treat. So the major problem that we have currently is things like infrastructure, financing, human resources. And I think this is where we have the problem in terms of going full-blown into test and treat. We've got sites that have been there since 2004. They are the same. There's no space even for HIV commodities at that particular place. So we have now resorted to supplying every quarter instead of every 6 months. So you can see the constraints that are there. Now, to think of moving from there forward, I think that's where we have a problem as a program. I don't know what your thoughts are on that.
Thank you very much. And again, what you say is absolutely right. The first step being to get people freely tested, as we say, which probably implies that you go toward the community and you don't wait until they come to the health system. Indeed, even in this small project, in the context that I described, the health system itself, as it is organized, cannot cope with the organization. Or we felt, after discussing with both health professionals and the community, that the health system was too remote from the needs of the individuals. So we had to design some new models of care dedicated to the services, which is a combination of mobile services and health rally points that are closer to the people than the regular health clinics that are available. Whether, again, this is replicable, this is applicable elsewhere, whether other models, like in Malawi, with home ART initiation are better. But in any case, I do agree with you that reinforcing on moving one step further for the health system is critical as we move forward this objective.
Just have a question in the sense, of course, I mean, it's you mentioned about the health system's concerns, the resource constraints and the behavioral concerns. Do you see some policy constraints? Because, you know, when you look at sub-Saharan Africa, you have countries like South Africa, Zambia, and many countries which are doing very well have very open policies, Malawi, willing to take up. But there are countries that are really not necessarily, I mean, who have a long way to go still. Are these studies, do you think they have an influence on all those countries also? And also the other thing is, in the countries that you are doing these studies, do you have also connections with the government so that, you know, the findings are able to influence their policy making in Cote d'Ivoire and South Africa?
Yeah. I can only talk for the countries that I know, but certainly for South Africa, not only there is a dialogue, but there is a strong interest of the South African authorities, at least at the provincial level, to get this rolling. And in fact, there is even a clear commitment for the Department of Health to take care of those who have been embarking in this initiative at the end of the trial, should it not work, for instance. So it has been very, very clear from the beginning. So I think in South Africa, there has been a high demand of information, of getting this kind of project rolling, that the POPART also is rolling in the Western Cape. And my belief would be that results will be translated into public health action. For other countries, that's less clear. I showed you that in Côte d'Ivoire, we are performing early ART programs. We have to remember that in Côte d'Ivoire was one of the first countries to do PMTCT studies in the early 90s, and still is one of the countries lagging behind in terms of coverage and impact toward the elimination. So sometimes having good research in a country can be very, very good for policymakers, and sometimes it doesn't make any difference, unfortunately.
Probably because of the other issues of civil unrest, etc. Thank you so much.
Let's.
Now we invite Dr. Fujisan.
how to use it. Okay. So good afternoon, everybody. It's, I'm a great honor to be here and to talk, tell a story about China Free ERT. So it's, you know, and this is a difficult time for me. Maybe, you know, China's still a developing country. We have a lot of and the barriers about scaling up ERT, including the economic and the technical and the patient education and others. So, you know, actually China initial free ERT by Chinese government and from 2003. From this slide you can find, you know, we are really paying attention for treatment, you know, we are scaling up ERT very rapidly. And during the last 10 years, you know, we have treated ERT patient accumulative 220,000 patients. And the blue line is cumulative patient. The right line is continuing to take ART patient. Especially in recent year, and we make a goal in the January, and we discuss with all of the China ART site and the provincial level, and to make a goal is how many patients will be treated in the this year. So actually, our ART, we are very proud. We have decreased mortality a lot. And from this slide, you can find before ART, China AIDS mortality is around 40-100% a year. Is after we scaling up ERT, we find, you know, our mortality decreased very rapidly. But you know, there is still a big gap between the AIDS patient mortality and the ART patient mortality. So some. And why and as mortality is still a big gap between the ART patient and the old China AIDS patient, we find, you know, treatment, the coverage is totally different. You know, in China we have the three group HIV AIDS patient, and the blue line is the former plasma donor patient, and the red line is the sex transmission AIDS patient. The green one is the IDU population. And you can find the three group people, the ART coverage is totally different. And also, it's a big difference for AIDS mortality. So, as mentioned before, China is still a very developing country. And at the beginning, ART beginning, and from 2003 and 2005, and we just full generic ART, and DVT, DDI, AZT, and nevirapine, and no any lab support. And from the 2005, and the CD4 testing available, you can find the CD4 testing monitoring and increasing every year, and from 2008, viral load testing available. And right now, and the patient follow-up rate and the CD4 and viral load testing monitoring is, I think, is very good. So, and because viral load monitoring available, so every year, my division, my colleague and I, and calculate and to do analysis about our treatment successful and treatment failure, you can find all the virological outcome is pretty good. And for new patients, the half year and 1 year is around 86.8% treatment successful. But over ART 3 years is around 55 point to the 81.4%. So if the patient did not have the viral testing during the last year, we think we assumed as a virological failure. So in some patient is not successful. So the next question is drug resistant. And during the last 3 years, the Chinese government and the Global Fund money support and the ART patient treatment failure drug resistant monitoring, we got some data but not published. We find in China that after ART treatment failure and the drug resistant prevalence is not very high. So is our topic is treatment as a prevention. And the first important thing is the ART coverage. And you can find if the patient's CD4 lies 350 in China, our ART coverage is pretty high. Also, we increasing every year. But if CD4 above 350, we can find in discontent couple group population, is ART coverage last year just 20%. Another very high risk population is a man sex with man, and very, very low, just 5.2%. So in this is the study and the paper by Dr. Shang Yiming, my colleague, and is his group and analysis about discordant couple and compare an ART patient and no ART patient and negative couple HIV new infection. And from this slide, and also show discounting couple ART coverage increasing. And they find the no ART cohort is 2.6 per 100% year new infection. This group patient and CD4 is pretty high. In the ART cohort is 1.3 per 100% year, and the patient baseline ART is very low, just 168 cells. And ART and reduce 26% the HIV new infection. It's a very interesting the result. In the first year, and the function is very good, but in so after 1 year and 2 years, and this functional decrease. Another very interesting result is in former plasma donor patient and sex transfer group population is working, but in the ideal population is not working very well. So and this is another is going on study is just focus on in a 2010 and 2011, just 1 year in a national ART cohort patient. And because why? And you know, is before 2010, you know, a lot of HIV testing and record is maybe a lot of bias or the wrong data. So from this result, we can find ART decrease 52% HIV transmission in these discontent couples. And you can find the ART group and the non-ART group is a significant difference. And also, you can find in the prolonged ART and the difference and become much bigger. So, and this is the China ART and the guideline. You know, and we initial the ART in 2003, and right now we have the three version China free ART guideline. This 2008, this is the last, the new guideline. So for ART patient, yeah, if CD4 and less 300 treated, if the patient CD4 between 350 and 500, and the high viral load, rapid decrease CD4 and the age people treated. And if the patient and pregnancy woman, HIV positive couple, and the sex partner, and co-infection, hepatitis B, and HIV is the kidney disease, and co-infection TB, so all of the patient, regardless CD4 high or low, and we treat them. But right now, and because WHO and published the new guideline, and more evidence to support treatment more earlier, so China right seriously considering and to revise the new guideline. So and we, you know, is ART is a lifelong. We should be considering in a treatment failure and a dropout ART patient. And in China, is every year around 9% patient and dropout from the ART cohort. So we find in the ideal population, the dropout rate is significantly higher compared to the other group population. And it's very bad news is, and we can find if the CD4 pretty high is over 350, is significantly higher the dropout rate. So if we should be paying attention, and for the higher CD4 patient, and more maybe the more counseling and the more education, and for those population. So in from all ART national database, and we can got some results. And one is ART can effectively reduce HIV transmission among the serodiscarding couple, and adherence is a very important thing. And also, in we cannot only rely on the ART, but also we need the condom promotion and education and other the intervention measures. So in for the lifelong and successful ART, and some thing we should be thinking, one is the patient's life quality and the side effects, and the stigma and the social and economic situation, and the medical resources, and the HIVDR, the drug resistance, and the drug-drug interaction. So, and I want to thank you, my colleague, Dr. Wu Zunyo, Dr. Shao Yiming, and some my colleague, and all of the doctors, the nurse, and the technician working for China for ART and program. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Fujian. Questions?
I wonder if you wouldn't mind commenting or expanding a little bit on what are the reasons that you think are responsible for the lower outcomes among injection drug users, and what plans may be underway to try to address that?
I think the ideal population is a very special. It's a China ideal population. It's the same with the other countries. It's they have a very, very special lifestyle. And, you know, it's from the medical things, and the expert, the doctor said, maybe ideal population is the patient. It's not only the social issues. So, you know, in China, in the ideal, the drug is not illegal. So, and we have a very good and the methadone maintained treatment program in China. If the patient, if the ideal patient like, they can go to the methadone maintained clinic and get a very, very cheap, just $1 per day for methadone. If the patient very, very poor, and they cannot pay. So, and the other is the ideal population, you know, is illegal. So, and the policeman may be arrested, and some the still taking the drug is ideal to the jail. So, and the other issues is those populations, the economic situation is very poor. So, and for some patient and move, and for drug, and some ideal population is a lot of reason. It's a very difficult to management. For ART, and we try to link, it's a free ART program and the methadone maintain program together, and we think maybe, and if the two program integrate together, maybe improve the ART, the ideal population ART outcomes.
Thank you. I'm Rishida Ferrand. I work in Zimbabwe. My question was to Prof. Dabi. Thank you for your talk, and particularly raising the issue that treatment as prevention would be an acceleration of all the issues that we are seeing currently. My particular question pertains to what is defined as success or of treatment as prevention. Are we looking at coverage and the numbers of people we are going to put on ART, or actually have we just need to also focus on the issue of sustainability of the intervention? Even at current times, we are maintaining about 50% of people at best on ART after a couple of years, 3 years, and that likely the attrition rate increases over time cumulatively, and also the virological suppression rate will decrease over time, as either due to adherence or as a natural failure of the regimens. So given that we're going to be increasing the numbers of people put on ART, how do you suggest that we address the issues not only of the current operational challenges but also maintaining treatment success? Otherwise, we're going to run into the same problems that we are seeing elsewhere around treatment resistance, transmission, et cetera, but on a much larger scale. So I'm particularly concerned about that issue.
I think if both of you can. So this is a good question, but it's very hard to give a good answer. You know, and this your question is my concern. You know, I'm an infectious disease physician. I'm working for HIV a long time. And before that, I'm working for the hepatitis. So, you know, and right now, is how to maintain the successful ART is a big challenge for us. And because the one is medical resources is still very limited in China, in the second line, and although the second line available, but we do know in the third line. So in for us, in we are using some indicator to monitoring ART, and just like in my slides show, one is CD4 monitoring and the viral testing. We try to diagnose the more earlier treatment failure, and then we switch from the first line to second line. And the other thing is adherence and education. And from our 10 years experience, and we find the ART outcome is pretty good. and it's over 70% is a patient is treatment successful, and although the taking ARV long patient a little bit higher compared to the new patient. And also, we're using the drug resistant monitoring from the national level. And we have the network in monitoring drug resistant from the national level. From the last 3 years' data, the drug resistant prevalence is stable. And this is a government and effort. And also, sorry, I forgot it. And the government gives the more money and for the better ARV. And from the last year, and our first line from AZT3TC plus nevirapine to TDF3TC and efavirenz. This treatment is much better compared to the last one. And also, in the government also and give the more money support to the NGO, and they want to encourage the social worker and the NGO people and also support the ART patient and to improve adherence. So, but a lot of physicians also concerned in the treatment failure, and how to maintain the ART program. And some people in tuberculosis treatment in China after 60 years anti-tuberculosis treatment, and China is the second big burden on the TB country, and a lot of drug resistance. Satisfying?
I would say. I think the challenges on the ground are not completely addressed by the figures. My experience of having worked in Zimbabwe, which is a very high prevalence country, is that we might pick up some of the viral resistant patients by drug resistance monitoring. We're certainly not picking up those who are lost to follow up, and that number increases over time, and they're being recycled in the community and transmitting infection, and that burden is likely to increase. So I think that whilst we can talk about adherence interventions, many of which might show positive behavioral effects in the short term, in the long term do not show any change in actual biological outcomes. So then the risk of transmission of virus will continue to increase. And my concern throughout the meeting has been that if we look at the coverage, the extra number of people we put on care, that's a very short-term outcome to be looking at.
Yeah, I fully agree with you. So, the quality and the quantity is the same important. So, for the big program and for the long-term successful treatment, I think the coverage and the successful and the equally is important for us.
Sorry to interrupt you, but I wanted to make a point, and I don't want to be taken lightly, but loss to follow-up in general is less likely to contribute to the spread of resistance because the wild-type virus resumes and so very quickly is replaced, and so that person, by definition, stops treatment, then most of the time it will revert to wild-type. And so the contribution to the spread of resistance will be minimum. Yeah. Transmission, yes, yeah. But you were talking about transmission of resistance, and I just wanted to make... Yeah, of course, but I just wanted to clarify that point.
Yeah. I just wanted to add to the answer that, first of all, we need to document the reduction in incidence, at least in some of these projects, to make sure that there is a clear direct relation between scaling up ART with test and treat universal and changing incidence. From a programmatic perspective in the long term, I'm a believer that it's more around community viral load assessment that probably we can learn how much progress there is. And the example of what has been done in the nationwide Swaziland survey this morning is quite remarkable. And third, the fact that we are, yes, using drugs that are more attractive now than a few years ago, even when we designed the TAS project, and now we have been able to introduce Atripla in South Africa, which now is rolled out as a regular drug, made the introduction of the program much simpler. So whether there will be a long-lasting formulations of drugs in the coming years will also make our life easier. And finally, you mentioned behavioral interventions, but it's a mix of behavioral and sometimes more high-tech, or so to speak, high-tech interventions. There are several studies extremely well conducted that have shown that text messages improve retention by at least 20%. And this is going all over the African continent at the moment. So there may be ways to improve what we remain one of the key challenges. I do agree with you, which is retention.
Thank you. Please allow me to ask you a question. I'm Suwat from Chiang Mai, Thailand. I think the way to have a treatment aspiration to successfully adapt to main important point. The first one, how we can pick up at the earlier stage of the HIV infection. That means you need to scale up HIV testing among the target group. And the second, how you can maintain a good adherence to the drug. I just want to ask you a suggestion from these two speakers, because most of the modern is talking about the HIV testing scale up. Most of the time, you're talking about a country who have a generalized epidemic. That's why home-based testing or community-based testing may be cost-effectively to apply. But like in China or in US or in Europe, even in many countries in Southeast Asia, they are concentrated epidemic. That means universal causing testing may be not cost-benefit. So what is your suggestion for the country who have a concentrated epidemic, like in MSM or IDU or sex worker? What kind of the model that you think will be appropriate for us to scale up HIV testing among this target group? Thank you.
Briefly, because there are two more
comments. We have this debate in our countries, like in France, for instance, but I know it's in the US, it's the same, and in the UK, whether, you know, sort of universal approach to testing versus testing in most at-risk populations is the best. At some point in time, models tended to favor universal testing, even in epidemics such as the one we are experiencing in France. But it was never fully implemented. So to be honest, we never translated these model recommendations into action. So my belief would be more to enhance activities toward most at-risk populations.
So I really, really liked the universal HIV testing. And you know, as my background is infectious disease. And in China, the hepatitis B and the hepatitis C is universal testing. I think universal HIV testing is cost-effectiveness. And for the HIV, it's the diagnosis. And the reduced HIV transmission is very, very important. And, you know, it's also China and the ART criteria is pretty high, but in, my colleague and do analysis in 2006, the baseline CD4, the average is 100, and after 2009, and the average baseline ART just 168. So you know, and we encourage the patient treatment more earlier, but. And the first HIV diagnosis, the CD4 is pretty high. In China, average, in the first HIV diagnosis, the CD4 less 50 is around 30%, 30%. So you can find it's a more earlier diagnosis, not only in for the HIV transmission, but also for more functional, the successful ART.
Thank you both very much for your talks. I have a question for Francois. As a leader of one of the major treatment as prevention clinical trials, I'm sure you've thought about the possibility, although we're all optimistic kind of people, but what if there's no difference? What if these studies show that there's no impact on incidence, which is the major outcome, primary outcome of these studies? How would we be able to use this information in formulating a policy and a way forward? Since the whole movement towards expanding treatment is kind of a mix of easier for programs to implement, individual benefit, plus the prevention benefit. So have you thought about kind of what would we do as a community with such a finding?
Of course, your point is well taken, as well as Julio's point earlier, that whether we will be able to achieve the trials in the evolving context. As you said, I mean, the primary goal is to show that incidence is changing and changing at the speed that we hypothesize. But as you said, there are other potential benefits that are expected on the health of the individuals and on also the general health, the tuberculosis. So there are many aspects that will need to be taken into account before making a final decision, although I do agree with you that if incidence was not shown to be any different, all the other criteria would become probably harder to sell in a public health recommendation.
Last comment.
Just picking up on the point about resistance.
Some microphone on this side too. Hey.
Sorry.
I've been here for a long time.
We have a problem with time, and I think it's already 3. Okay, but briefly, yeah, please.
No, I can wait, but I have been here since the beginning.
We'll have to ask Julio. I mean, the thing is, it's already 3 o'clock, and we need to maybe just...
I'll say it very quickly. It's, the point about resistance, you know, as and when we scale up antiretroviral therapy, and closer we get to 100% of people with HIV being on ART... We should be prepared for the fact that the way in which we measure transmitted drug resistance, percentage of new infections with transmitted drug resistance, that is inevitably going to rise. So by our current measure, that seems like it's potentially a bad thing, but in fact, we need to be measuring the incidence of new infections with transmitted drug resistance. So we should be prepared, as and when we're more successful in treating more people, for increases in the percentage of new infections with transmitted drug resistance. But we shouldn't think it's a bad thing.
We'll have one more comment.
Yeah, just a comment for Dr. Shang. 3 weeks ago, I was attending, as part of my organization, Advocacy for Treatment as Prevention, at the G20 summit in Russia. And then, since I like to compare countries, I bring with me some comparisons about the HIV epidemics in the 20 leading countries of the world. It means the biggest economies of the world. And then what we use is just the total number of people living with HIV and the total number of people on ART, and then rank them. And China came number 18, just above Russia, which ranked number 19. But having that huge economy, I think what you are presenting here is great. It's really convincing, and I'm sure you have convinced the Ministry of Health, but then you need to convince the Ministry of Finance too, because I really think China can do a lot more. And right now, ranking number 18, it's not a good comparison there. Of course, you can always say we are better than Russia, but that's
thank
my
you.
Comment.
You know, and it's a government really commitment for HIV prevention and control. And from my talk, and you can find a government, and right now it's purchased and provide free medication, first line, second line, and CD4 testing, viral testing, and drug resistance testing. And, you know, and for us, and personally, I think in the HIV screen and diagnosis is the first priority things. And for ART, if patient like, and we can treat everyone. And right now, China is the health system change a lot. And if patient is very poor, you know, the government and support in medical service. Yes, the question is for us, you know, another challenge is the HIV and AIDS patients are very, very poor. They are living in the poor rural area. And, you know, in China is maybe it's most of the audience and just saw in China in the TV and in the big city like in my hometown, Beijing and Shanghai is very modern maybe. But you know, the poor rural area is so poor. So you know, the China face a lot of challenge. And it's to the health system improve is one. And you know, is if we want to improve health system in China, we should be improve the poor rural area, everything. You know.
Thank you. But of course, you know, just to conclude, I think it's also important from the presentations it comes out the importance of marginalized communities, key populations, and you know about the IDU. So along with investments, I think we also need to acknowledge communities that are marginalized and make sure that their rights are preserved and we actually counter anti-discriminatory laws. So it is challenging, but we have heard excellent presentations, and I think it's a thought-provoking one for you to get back and analyze and see from the country level and to look for solutions. Thank you very much.
Thank you.